Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening, happy Shabbat, and happy Shabuah to one and all. Hello, Kirk. Hello, James. How are you guys?
Good evening. Great.
Doing good.
Good. I'm a little under the weather today. My son and daughter-in-law are out at a 5-day wedding celebration of one of my son's colleagues, who is Indian, so they're having a long ceremony as part of their culture up in Detroit. So my wife and I and youngest son are enjoying our granddaughter. And this morning, as I was slipping on her leggings, getting her all prepared to go to school, she's a little under 2 years old. I reached too far out when I picked her up and popped something in my back. So I have been to the chiropractor. I have done hot pads and ice. I have done massage. I've done, I think, 5 rounds now of electric stimulation. We put those pads. There's a electric shock thing that stimulates the message. I had 2 treatments of it at the chiropractor, where I got an adjustment. It was on their stretching rack, and then I bought a unit so I could continue with it, and I've done another 3 or 4 sessions here at home. The standard painkillers, which I only have, Excedrin and Advil and that sort of thing, are not putting a dent in it. And, you know, I understand that that I happen to be living here in the heroin and fentanyl capital of the world. But, you know, I'm not going the Oxycontin, prescribed or otherwise. I'm not going down that street. I've seen way too much of what it does to people. What happens is that you pinch a nerve, and then the muscles all spasm trying to stabilize the injury. And so the real pain isn't really the pinched nerve. It's all of the muscles trying to stabilize the injury. And they just need to chill out and relax. And the ice is supposed to be good for the inflammation. And we'll see how we're feeling tomorrow, but it'll be a short one for me tonight, just because breathtakingly painful. You know, I do have.
You can always take a few shots of liquid painkiller.
Oh yeah, the stuff that they put right there in the they can shoot right into that area. Yeah,
I just had a couple shots of whiskey. Relax yourself a bit.
It's so funny because you're
saying that. Then he'll swear his words.
I have a bottle of Glenmorangie, which is 18-year-old scotch that my youngest son bought me. He was a bartender just as a kind of a hobby to pass the time while he was in graduate school. And that was his favorite scotch. And And I probably had the equivalent of 3 ounces out of it since he bought it for me 5 years ago. And when I was making my coffee for the show, I looked at it and I said, you know, if there was ever a time that looked appealing, right now it looks appealing. It was right next to my coffee maker down here in my basement office. And I said, yeah, that looks appealing. So I almost did it. I am coming to you.
I don't know about putting that in coffee, but
I am coming to you.
That is a very good scotch. I can I know that one personally. So
I used to be to some degree a non-snooty wine enthusiast. You know, I like a number of varietals of wine. You know, I'm glad that likes wine, makes wine. You know, there's a number of unique wines that I find very appealing, like Malbecs. Most people don't ever drink Malbecs, but from Argentina. And Shiraz, which is from Australia, some of my favorite wines.
I do like a good Shiraz.
Yeah, and then I've also become really fascinated with, because both of my sons are into microbrews, and there really are marvelous microbrews, and I've gotten to enjoy almost every flavor. There's so many different flavors between the yeast and the hops and the malts and the various brewing styles, and that's been interesting as well. So I'm not much of a drinker, but
that's my second favorite hobby next to translating is my home brewing.
Yeah, my eldest and his wife homebrew constantly, and really great beers. And my youngest and I are consumers. So we'll, I'll have a beer probably 5 days a week. I'll have a beer in there. We choose a lot of our restaurants because of their microbrew menu. And so, I'm not a you'll never find me going to the store and buying a six-pack of a standard. You know, I'm not going to buy a Bud Light or
Coors
a Silver Bullet. No, not going to do it. But, I enjoy the, there's about 10 world-class national microbrews, and probably in every place in the country you live, there's probably 8 to 10 local microbrews that are excellent. And
more coming every day.
This is really not off topic when we're talking about, it was Feast, of which this is Shavua. Shavua is the one with the most extensive menu, as a matter of fact. At his feast, it's meats, grains, and olive oils, as well as fermented beverages, wine in particular.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to be enjoying really fine cuisine for a good long time.
I like that plan.
I like that plan too. I just, in fact, I like the idea of being able to eat without the physical consequence. We can be as skinny as I don't think that light has any weight. So we can eat to our heart's
content.
Yeah, I ain't
gotta worry about my calorie counting.
No, it's best of all worlds. Well, this is the Feast of Weeks. I don't use that term very often. Shavua is the primary name that Yanoa has coined for it. Shemisim, sometimes. Shemisim is just 50s. Shavua is basically a multiple of sevens or a multiple of Shabbats. And since Shabbat means an oath or promise and it's based on the number seven, it's the promise of seven. It's the promise of the Shabbat, the oath of the Shabbat. It's seven Sabbaths, for example. You know, it is the day that is completely, from its name point of view, completely immersed in Yahweh's terminology. So it is stunning that Christians, and I received a letter today from Fred talking about how he shares Yahweh's testimony with his Christian family, and you know they just have a connection that they call him a Judaizer, which is a term that Paul created. Of course, there is no such thing as a Judaizer. You have to be an imbecile to even use the term, because Jews have never tried to convert somebody to their race, because that's impossible. They've never tried to convert somebody to their religion. They're really snooty about that. And they don't try to convert somebody to observing the Torah. So the term Judaizer has never been such a thing. It is a myth created by Paul. And as
what's funny is that's something they actually have in common with Yahweh. Yahweh doesn't try and convert anyone to his way. He just tells you this is it.
That's exactly
what you want.
No, that's right. That's right. In fact, that was one of the things that the original letter that we were all responding to was written by Brad, where he says, you know, there's some sense of almost depression that that comes along with the frustration of knowing that those that he loves are unreceptive to Yahweh's testimony. And I think it's something we've all gone through. Kirk, you've talked about it a lot.
Well, yeah, of course I've raised, though. I mean, it's this is
Yeah, I have, too.
You've got free will. I've got free will. If you're not interested, then I can't do a thing about it.
That's correct. And for me, the two things that caused me to relax about it and just to say, would I love my eldest son and daughter-in-law and therefore ultimately granddaughter and my wife to accept Yahweh's plan? Absolutely. Would love it. But I have nothing to do with it. You know, and there was a period of time where I said, you know, if I could only live a better life, as a better example, if I knew more, if I could present the Yahweh's case better, if I could be more compelling in my presentation, that would make a difference. And I came to realize, no. Because I could be the most compelling, most brilliant, best example in all of human history. And my success rate would be no better than it is now.
Yeah.
But look at
you know how we know that?
Yeah.
Exactly. We have that example.
That.
We have the best
person
possible.
Right. Yep. And then on the, you know, being a better example, I look at Toad. No one was a more effective witness, and yet as an example of someone to follow, he was a wreck. So I just realized that our situation as it relates to sharing with other people, and that, by the way, is the basis of Shavua. It's all about – Shavua is about sharing. We're being empowered. We're being enriched. And the only reason – in my view, that we're being empowered, enriched in this life, enlightened in this life, is to be a more effective witness so that other people and those that we love and care about will at least have the opportunity to know Yahweh. And James and Kirk, one of the things that caused me to relax about this this whole thing that I know is still bothering Brad, and that's natural, and it's good that it bothers him, I think, too, that over time, even as a caring individual, it will bother him less and less, is this realization that those Brad knows and loves, those Kirk that you know and love, those that you know and love, JB, and that Fred in his letter know and love, all of them have a much better opportunity to come to know Yahweh than any of us did. Much better. I didn't have anybody reaching out to me and saying, hey, this is, here's a more accurate translation. Here's who I am. This is how I differ from religion. Here's the things that you need to walk away from if you're going to come to know. I mean, the whole thing from beginning to end was it was a lonely trip. And there was no one to reach out to. I can't tell you of a single resource, a single author, a single spokesperson, a single teacher, not a single individual that reached out to me along the way and said, here's some insights that should be helpful to you.
Probably to the contrary.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah, lots
stumbling
of
blocks everywhere.
So what are you doing? You're mad?
Yeah, that's right. And so those that we know and that know us are in a much more advantageous position. The only thing that keeps them from accepting the truth is their unwillingness to do so.
Mm-hmm.
They have no interest in it because we not only had to have an interest in it, but we had to forge, plow the ground.
It had to be a very intense
it.
Interest.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And with so many others, we're literally in a position to hand it to them, serve it over to them at any time. Now, I'm a little uncomfortable when I say that, though, because of the fact that those who have, in fact, I think it's almost uniformly, those who have come to know Yahweh because we plowed the ground, we did these translations, we came to think about it, and then were enriched by the insights that his words provided. There's not a single one of them that I'm aware of that just said, oh, well, thank you for making that clear. I'll accept that and go on with my life. Everybody, without exception, says, I want to learn more. I want to study more. I want to go on this journey. So while
That's
I think there's an
thread.
Advantage. Yeah, it's a common thread. So while there's an advantage to those we know and love, if they were to capitalize on it, they would join us in the search, and now we have many people that are part of the search. The thing about Shavuah that really should strike the world's leading religion, those that practitioners, believers in the world's leading religion, Christianity, across the side of the head, is that it is Shavuah. It is based upon the number 7 and the Shabbat. And since it is based upon the Shabbat and the number 7, and it's the only one of the 7 Mikra that they even make an attempt to observe because they think it demarks the birth of their church and nothing could be further from the truth, it is enveloped in the Shabbat, in Yahweh's plan of 7. And so it's impossible to get away from that. The other thing is that its timing. In fact, here's the first statement about it. And Kara called out Leviticus 23:15. It says, "Accurately count, shofar, reckon, record, relate, rehearse, and regale. From the day after Mahorat, the next day following the Shabbat." From the day you came forth and bore the sheath of grain, as an ascending wave offering, a total of 7 complete Sabbaths. Now, the key here is that Shavuah does not stand alone.
No.
Shavuah is 7 sevens from Bukurim, or 7 sevens plus 1 from matzah. The entire celebration of it is introduced with accurately count. Reckon, understand that from the day after the Shabbat, from the day you came forth and bore the sheath of grain as an ascending wave offering, a total of 7 Sabbaths. Now, when he talks about from the day of the Shabbat, this is not a natural Shabbat. This is the Shabbat of matzah.
Yeah.
And so accurately count from that time. So this is directly associated with matzah and from Bukurim, firstborn children. And so if you were just thoughtfully open to that introduction of Shavuah, which Christians call Pentecost, thinking that God somehow communicated in Greek and used the Greek word for 50, and that they should transliterate a Greek word which was never spoken by God, and that they were free to change his Hebrew name, which has meaning, into a Greek word that has no meaning. That if you just realize that it is the timing of it is 7/7 from the third Mikra from Bukurim, or 7/7 plus one from Matzah. That's a time of development. You know, you're born as you're perfected and given eternal life on Pesach and Matzah. And Pesach and Matzah are one event. You know, Pesach is eternal life, the doorway to life. Matzah is the means of perfection. They are one event, and the result is Bukurim, being a firstborn child into Yahweh's home, born into the first family. And it is 7/7, the promise of seven from that point to that we are mature enough to be enriched, to be empowered, to be enlightened. You know, you don't go from being a brand new child to being effective as a witness. 7/7 in there. You need time to mature, time to grow, time to learn. And that's why it is 7/7 away. It isn't, and you know, these are the first four Mikra. These are the four that have been fulfilled. These are the four that enable all of the benefits, all five benefits of the covenant are enabled through them. And yet they are not in four successive days. I was going to say the key word here, beyond the fact that Christians dismiss this recognition that there is a very specific time for Shavua, and that it's not based upon the day of a week, it's not based upon the day of a month. It's based entirely on the on 7/7 from firstborn children, from the third Moed Mikre to the fourth Moed Mikre. And that connection through Shafar, accurately count, reckon, and record, relate to, is completely lost, because you never, ever hear a Christian pastor talk about Pentecost being directly related and timed based upon Bukurim, firstborn children, ever.
I've never heard anybody talk about Bukurim.
That's probably also true.
No, yeah, Easter Bukurim. Sunday.
That's a new word to the Christian community.
Yeah, Bukurim would be, I don't think there's one Christian in the world that knows that Bukurim is actually the event that they speak of on Easter Sunday, when Easter, of course, is a pagan term, and Sunday is irrelevant. But I don't think there's a single one of them that knows that the actual event, in terms of being freed from Sheol and returning as light, being transformed into the firstborn unto the Father, is Bukurim. And they don't even know of Matzah, that took place on the Shabbat. They think it's all a celebration, somehow a replacement for Passover. But it isn't. You know, so there's no understanding of any of these kinds of things. You know, Shavuot provides a perspective, if you will, from which to review the most important fulfillments of Yahweh's Moed Mikre. You know, 7/7 plus one is central to God's provision, his plan and his timing. Everything pertinent to our salvation, to our relationship, occurs in Yobel years, and the Shavua is an annual celebration of the Yobel. Shavua's 7/7 plus one. The Yobel is 7/7 plus one. The only difference between Shavua and the Yobel is that Shavua is 7 weeks plus one, and Yobel is 7 years. Seven times 7 years plus one. So 7 times 7 days plus one, or 7 weeks plus one, or 7 times 7 years plus one. So it's either 50 years or it's an annual event. And so everything that you need to know about Yanuo's timing relates to the Yobel, and Shavua is simply an annual celebration of it. In fact, the Shabbat is the weekly celebration of Shavua, which is the annual celebration, which then points to the Yobel, which is celebrated twice a century. Anyhow, you look back at the Yobel years, that would be important, recognizing that 40 is the time of testing. You go 40 Yobel after Adam's and Chawa's expulsion from the Garden of Eden in 3968 BCE, takes you to 1968 BCE, when Abraham passed the test with Yishak and affirmed his commitment to the covenant with Yahweh on Mount Moriah. And that foreshadowed what would occur on Passover in the exact same location 40 Yobel later, with Yahusha serving as the sacrificial lamb in the Yobel year of 4000 Yah, which was now 33 CE. And that timing is so essential to our understanding, because all we have to do is move forward 40 Yobel from 33 CE, and you get...
Bingo.
2033. Yeah, 2033.
Now, why do you have reservations from time to time when you talk about this and you say we could be off a little bit? What is it about the 33 CE that has a little bit of a wavering there? You know, so sometimes
I have no question whatsoever that the dates we've just described occurred on 2000 and 4000 Yah, and that the culminating fulfillment will occur on 6000 Yah. Now, the issue becomes correlating Yahweh's calendar with the Imperial Rome transition to Roman Catholic pagan calendar.
Yes.
So to say that Yahweh will return on Yom Kippurim in 6000 Yah is without question. Is 6000 Yah 2033? Yes, it is, if 4000 Yah was 33 CE. Now, I come to 33 CE for a lot of different reasons. One of the reasons to come to it is that if you look at the Daniel prophecy and you realize that that this triggering date is 444 BCE, and then you do the math using the prophetic years, you come to 4 days before Passover and 33 CE on the Roman pagan calendar. Yosha walked into Jerusalem as the Passover lamb. And so that's pretty compelling. The second is that there's only 1 year within six of that time, three on either side, where the days of the week align, where the Passover would have begun on Thursday evening.
Friday.
Yeah, it would have continued through Friday. That matzah would have begun the special Shabbat and would have fallen on a natural Shabbat, something that Yahweh would have, of course, arranged for the most important fulfillment of matzah, which is a Shabbaton, a special Shabbat, to fall on a natural Shabbat. That occurred in 33 CE, making the first day of the week, as it was recorded by the eyewitnesses, the date for the celebration of Bukurim, firstborn children. So if you go back in time 3 years, even to 30 CE, or forward all the way to 36 CE, that's the only year where the dates align. That's the reason why when somebody tells me your celebration of the Shabbat starting on a Friday evening into a Saturday is invalid, and I said, well, you know, it was certainly valid in 33 CE. And then the other thing that strikes me is that if you look at 2033 as your 6000 Yah, Yom Kippurim occurs on a Monday at sundown, so that the special, the most special Shabbaton of Sukkah The ultimate celebration of the Shabbat actually begins on a Friday, the 5th. Becomes a Friday in the 15th of the month of the 7th month is a Friday at sundown. So it's a natural Shabbat, and which you'd expect. So you put those things together, and
it's hard to deny.
It is really hard to deny. We're also told that there will be a blood moon upon his return, and Sukkah always occurs on a full moon. The eclipses only occur on full moons. There will be a full moon visible in Yisrael, which will create a red moon in 2033 on Sukkah. There's a lot of evidence.
It's compelling.
That validates that as the choice. And then you've got another one, which is that 968 BCE is the most uniformly accepted date for the laying of the cornerstone for the House of Yahweh by Dode, 968 BCE. Well, that was a Yobel year, and that's exactly 1,000 years from 33 CE, because it was the geniuses of the Roman Catholicism didn't recognize that you can't go from 1 BCE to 1 CE, and yet they did. They forgot year zero. 968 BCE is when the cornerstone was laid. That's a Yobel year, 1,000 years exactly to that timing. And then you have other things like the timing of Yashaya's great pronouncement unto us: a child is born unto us, a son is given. That occurred exactly 777 years prior to its ultimate fulfillment. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that certainly point in the right direction here. So, anyway, those are my thoughts as to why I think it is 2033. But I don't like being dogmatic. I've made too many mistakes. I'm actually delighted that I make mistakes. I'm not bothered by them at all. It keeps you humble. It keeps you from being dogmatic. I think when people move to the point where they are dogmatic and say, this is such, I say it as such, if you argue with me, you're wrong, I think you get yourself in that's a bad attitude. I think it's better to say, learning is fun. Every day we learn, we have the opportunity to replace things that we found not to be true with that which is true. We refine our understanding. But I have not seen anything that would suggest that that year 6,000 Yah is anything other than 2033. Again, I'm really uncomfortable being dogmatic when we're dealing with a transition, trying to calibrate Yahweh's calendar to the most dreaded calendar in all of human existence. I mean, it's the Julian
calendar based on Babel.
Correct. And it's so interesting, too, that, Rome had both had an eight-day and a six-day week. All of the world, eight-day and six-day weeks. It's like the natural. If you look at the moon cycles and the year, you'd want to have a six-day week. Almost everything fits a six-day week. To have a seven-day week, nothing works anymore in terms of the arrangement of time. So it is man, and it is natural to have a six-day week. Rome had a six-day week. The only reason Rome and the rest of the world converted to a seven-day week is because of Yahweh's testimony. And so what you see is, even with the Roman pagan calendar, even with each of the days of the week having pagan names associated with them. They still have, there's still little aspects of the truth woven into it to make them, you know, more credible. But nonetheless, this Shavuot is an extremely important insight into Yahweh's timing. Now, God wants us to shafar, and that's the verb that he used, which means to accurately relate. And in this case, without Bukodim, there is no Shavuot. If you don't have the child, if the child is not born, then there is no enriching and power.
You're never able to share.
That's exactly right. You know, if you didn't have your daughter, there'd be no purpose. There'd be no one to teach, no one to lift up,
yeah.
No one to empower.
My, as Abraham put it, my inheritance is meaningless.
Correct. Yeah, because I have no child. Yeah, doesn't. That's right. The inheritance. Abraham was perfect in that. You know, what you're offering me is meaningless. Now, what Abraham did not know is that the inheritance was the covenant, and therefore it was meaningful to him. But his statement is still explains that without an heir, the inheritance is meaningless. It was actually meaningful to Abraham, which is what God showed him. But he said, well, here's what you, as my child, are going to inherit, because I'm giving the benefits of the covenant to you. Now, the wave offering associated with firstborn children, whereby the newly born spiritual children of God are lifted up, is tangibly manifest during seven Sabbaths, with the same souls now being enriched and empowered by the set-apart spirit, preparing them to become more effective witnesses. As a result, the Mikra of Shavuah enables two of the covenant's promises. While celebrating our relationship with God, none of which would be possible if we hadn't first become beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukodim. You know, collectively, it is how that the 4 days working together equip us not only to enter Yahweh's company, but equip us to help others do the same. You know, that's why that letter from Brad and the responses that we received on it today are so meaningful, because it is Shavuah that empowers us to be effective witnesses. Now, before anybody jumps to the wrong conclusion, when we share Yahweh's testimony, as we're doing now, we are effective witnesses. His testimony does what it is intended to do, provide people with an understanding of the path to God. The fact that somebody says, I don't want to listen to it, I don't like what you're saying, I want to continue to believe my religion, has nothing to do with whether or not we have been enriched and empowered to share this testimony. The very fact that we love it, that we learn from it, that we grow from it, is proof that it is effective. But look, the covenant is unlike religion. You know, in Islam, you either convert or die. And in Christianity, conversion is essential to the religion. They want you to be saved by their religion. They want you to join their church. Yahweh is not that way. The offer is there. If you want to accept it, great. If you don't, that's your choice. Like in Brad's letter, when he was talking about how it's depressing that some people that he loves aren't receptive, it's one of the reasons why I have become convinced that, and Yahweh's testimony seems to affirm this, that God doesn't know those who don't know him.
Yes.
If he did, it would be miserable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, knowing that you're offering somebody the most wonderful gift in the world, and that you're being not only turned down, but your gift is being trashed by those under the influence of Satan would be so incredibly disheartening that if God knew those individuals, he'd be devastated. I mean, that, and you know, it's like when he talked about having to destroy humans with an asama during the flood. That's just a small taste as to what God would have experienced if he knew those who had rejected him. There was something today that I read that it was just, and I don't want to get much in the news, but you probably all know that Trump pulled America out of the World Climate Kyoto Accord.
Well, the treaty, whatever it was.
Yeah, the treaty. Well, I happen to agree with pulling America out, but if you're going to pull America out, you need to provide a much more reasonable explanation as to why you're doing so. That the Chancellor of Germany, her statement was introduced by the media saying she's the daughter of a Christian pastor, and her saying, you know, that we need to stand up for our creation. And if you say, wait a minute, our creation? What in the hell did you create? Did you create the myth of man-made global warming? Did you create the Kyoto Accords for wealth redistribution in a one-world socialist government? I mean, that would be your creation. But I'm going to tell you, Angela Merkel, you didn't create the universe. It's not our creation. Yahweh's creation. And then the next thing she said is that we need to protect Mother Earth.
Oh, well, that's good.
Wow.
Holy Mother Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're right back to the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God and Mother Nature and Mother Earth and deifying the creation. It just shows you how terribly the world is lost. And of course, then the little protesters are out there with their signs, people, not prophets. And you just say, what is it that's wrong with you that you don't understand? How would you feed people if there wasn't a profit incentive to do so? How would you house them if there wasn't a profit incentive to do so? How would you even have the paper that your sign was written on, the stick that you stuck it to, or the Crayola that you used to draw it? How would you have any of that, as well as the car that took you there, or the fuel that you put in that car, if it wasn't for the profit incentive?
Well, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his need.
Yeah, and how long
you know
is that going to work? The only way that that the government can provide everything without a profit incentive is for everyone to be slaves to the state. If the state controls your life in a communist system, everyone is a slave to the state. They're owned and controlled by the state. That is the only way that the state can provide, and even then it does such a miserable job without a profit motive that the communist systems all implode. What were you going to say, Kirk?
Well, I was going to say this. The old thing they used to say in school where when there was everybody, when America started giving away millions of dollars for everything and foreign aid,
right,
and everything, they said, well, why don't we just give everybody $1 million and we'd be all fine? And so if you extrapolate that, everyone now gets $1 million, and then in the old days, you go out to your front porch and you don't find your newspaper. So you call Charlie down the street and you say, Charlie, where is your little boy Billy? He's supposed to deliver my paper. He said, well, God, Kirk, he's got $1 million. What the hell would he want to deliver your paper for?
Right.
If there's nothing
to
gain.
You go to the market and there's no food in the market.
No work.
And you say, well, why aren't you, I got my $1 million. I want to buy the food. Yeah, that's just the idea of giving everybody the living wage.
No, why would I bother picking it?
Yeah, why work
why would you grow the food? Yeah. Why would you work on the farm? Why would you work on the
ranch?
It
would take about a week or two, and the same guys
would
have
you,
a
why
the money
because
they would sell the amount of watermelon costs $100.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, then you get, you know, pre-World War II Germany, where people are pushing around wheelbarrows full of cash in order to go buy a loaf of bread.
Nothing, yeah. There has to be some reason to make you want to get up and do these things. Work is tough.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Well, actually, work, yeah, can't.
But it's fun. I enjoy work. But it's still
I don't think of work as tough. I think work is its own reward, and that work is a built character. It creates a sense of worth and of value, and that if you don't work, that you don't grow, that you are a net parasite if you don't work.
Well, you know, you're a perfect example, Craig. You don't have to work. You're retired. You have enough money to live on the rest of your life. What do? You get up every day and do you just sit around and do nothing? No.
Nope.
You translate.
Nope.
You study.
Yep,
you write. You do shows.
Yep.
Yeah, if
yep.
you didn't, you'd be miserable. I know people
right.
who are retired and don't work, don't do anything,
right.
and they are the most miserable people you will ever meet.
Yeah,
my Patty's grandmother, she's 92. She physically is incapable of doing anything. Yeah, you know, she can barely do most things around the house, and it makes her miserable. She hates that she can't do what she used to be able to do.
Right,
and
you know we have a house
it makes you miserable.
Here
you're
and,
not productive. You don't have anything to do.
Right. We have a house here in Ohio. We don't have a maid. My wife and I keep it clean. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. We have a garden with lots of flowers in our yard. We go to the store. We buy the flowers. We plant the flowers. We water the flowers. We don't have somebody to do that. We do it ourselves. Get dirty and do it. This past week and a half, I have been translating an entire chapter that I have translated before, Jeremiah 23. It is the most anti-religious text, I think, in all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And what I really should be experiencing is frustration, because as I look at my translations of that, which I wrote for An Introduction to God, which, you know, wasn't all that long ago. That was probably 5 or 6 years ago that I wrote that, that there isn't a single phrase that I'm able to leave as it was. Not one. Not one. I mean, and sometimes the changes are really substantial. Now, there isn't anything that is an understanding or a conclusion that is changed by an improvement of the translations. But there's an understanding that, wow, I wasn't very good at it.
It's
5 years ago. Yeah, it's just they were incomplete and not as accurate as they could be or should be, and that the insights that you can glean from doing a better job are substantially beyond anything that I saw 5 years ago. And so I'm looking at it as, wow, I'm growing. I'm learning. This is really fun, you know. And it also gives you a sense of humility. Because rather than saying, "Wow, you know, these are really good translations now compared to those translations then," I'm really good at it. No. When you say, you know, if 5 years ago I did this poor job compared to what I'm doing now, if I
imagine
were to do this again 5 years,
from,
from now, yeah, exactly. So you, but it's a good thing that you're growing. But that I just share that because that's the work that I'm doing. And it's,
you know, the day I get to the point where I can't learn anything new, that's going to be a very sad day for me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, this whole.
Which I don't think even in eternity we're going to be at that point.
I don't think, not a single day. I think that's why eternity. I think that's why Yahweh made being part of his family dependent upon knowledge and understanding. Knowledge being yada. Become familiar with, be aware of, and understanding from BN to make the necessary connections so as to understand, is that if you didn't enjoy learning and knowing and expanding your basis of understanding, if that wasn't thrilling to you, then eternity would be boring. And in fact, you'd be a drain. You'd be depressing on the rest of us. So the idea, makes it such that...
That's where I've gotten to the point now that when you share things with people...
You can't pass me. I'm on the phone.
And they have no interest in doing any study on their own or otherwise.
Right.
I just don't worry about it anymore because that's the one ingredient that I absolutely have talked to so many people that are part of the family, and that was the one thing that just about, I didn't mean they all came around the corner at the same time. Some of them took a lot longer to walk around the block that they got there. But they did their own due diligence, whatever that may have been, to solve the question they had, and they went after it. And if you don't go after it, they're not interested. Don't worry about them. They don't want it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to spend eternity with people who have no interest in learning anything else?
Well, more importantly,
I don't enjoy being around those people now.
Yeah.
No, I don't either. You know, it's like Fred when he was talking about his family, and they when he tells them what God said, they have no interest. They use Paul to justify their hatred of all things. You'd think that you'd say, all right. So you think that Paul is was inspired by God to contradict God? So why don't you either read Questioning Paul, or why don't you do it yourself? Why don't you set what Paul said against what God said and try to resolve those conflicts? And if you find that you can't resolve the conflicts, why don't you admit that he obviously lied? You know, do it yourself. Instead of just believing your religion, take the time and do some fact-checking. Compare what Yosha said to what Paul said.
But then you
compare
don't have
what
faith, right?
To what Paul said. Pardon?
But then you don't have faith.
You just have
to have faith that this is all true.
Yeah.
Faith is what matters.
Yeah, well, it doesn't to God. He says,
why wouldn't they want to do that to save your soul if they're so intent on saving your soul?
Oh, absolutely.
Putting another scalp on their
right.
belt.
Yeah.
They should say, well, let me prove to you that you're absolutely wrong.
They never do that.
All along. Prove me wrong.
Yeah.
If you're so worried that I am going to hell for what I'm telling you, prove me wrong. Show me the evidence.
I'm willing to change. I went from being
an atheist to someone who spends several hours a week translating scripture. Now, I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong when the evidence is there. If you think I'm wrong, prove it.
Fine.
Right.
That's fine.
Right. That's right. Go where the words lead. I will go where the words lead. You show me evidence and reason to the contrary. I can show you 20,000 pages of analysis that verifies what we're saying. But, you know, if you can show that any of it's untrue, then have at it.
We'll explore it, yeah.
Yeah, we'll explore it. Next he says, always and forever. That would be for a very long time, wouldn't it? I guess... That means that
forever.
Always and forever, eternally and into perpetuity, it's add. You shall accurately count, reckon, record, relate, rehearse, and regale. Shafar, that's that thinking word again.
Mm-hmm.
That is the accounting word, shafar. That's the word which, for those who say no one knows the time or the hour, you're unfamiliar with the concept of the Hebrew shafar, accurately count. The day of 50, Yom Kesizim, starting from the next day after the seventh Shabbat. And you should choose without reservation or interruption to come near and approach the renewing, restoring, and affirming gift to approach Yahweh. Well, there's a mouthful for you. Always and forever, so... Shavuot is an eternal celebration of God, and it is such as Shemitah, or as Shavuot, not as Pentecost. And it has a very specific time that is not based upon the day of the week, because Christians will always have it on a Sunday. Their Pentecost is always on a Sunday, and Of course, that's not God's schedule. And that it is from the day after the seventh Shabbat. So seven sevens plus one from matzah, which is seven sevens from Bikurim. They're forever tied. That's the starting point. They one is an outgrowth of the other. Without matzah and Bikurim, there is no Shabuah. Shabuah is meaningless. It's not just that the timing doesn't exist. It is meaningless without matzah and Bikurim, which is why this is being repeated. And he says, so what does he want you to do? Without reservation, you should choose to come near and approach Karab. Now, Karab is that word that that somebody thought maybe should be translated make an offering. But all Karab means is to approach, come near, come into the midst. There isn't anything associated with the word that would cause you to render it make an offering. Not offering.
I've come across
make.
That word many a time, and never once would that definition fit it.
No, ever. And so it means come and approach, Karab. You should have your own belief. By the way, this is a mikra. Yahweh even announces and that this is a mikra. It's an invitation. What do you do with an invitation? You answer. You come near. You approach.
You respond.
The feast. You
what
respond.
Could you possibly be offering at this feast? How could you?
You know what? What
yeah,
word
you
do mikra and karab have in common? Kara.
Kara.
Yeah. Mikra and Karab are both based on Kara.
They are. QR is in both of them. So they're based on Kara, the invitation. And what are we approaching? Well, we're approaching the renewing, restoring, and affirming gift to approach Yahweh. You know, when we are transformed into light, whether that happens on Teruah for us or happens before Teruah, the fulfillment of Teruah, do we succumb naturally before that time? That transformation is when God does this literal empowering, where we are become seven-dimensional, when we are transformed from all of the failings of a physical body and a material three-dimensional object to seven dimensions. So this particular day, to be enriched and empowered, this is a huge diminishment from the ultimate enrichment and empowerment. It's a foreshadowing of it. It is a way of saying, all right, on this day what we're going to celebrate is you being enlightened and enriched with my Torah, with my teaching, with the ability to understand and to speak, and you're going to grow up and be nurtured more fully in my word. But this is just a small sampling of what the ultimate enrichment and empowerment that is going to come as part of the Torah when we're transformed into light. But the first four mikra collectively is this renewing and affirming and restoring gift that enables us to approach Yahweh. Why? Because this particular Moed Mikra, Shabuah, is the fourth, and as the fourth, is the first four collectively fulfilled each of the promised benefits of the covenant, and the covenant is Yahweh's means to renew, to restore us, and to enable us to approach Him. And they are tied to, the covenant is tied directly to these first four mikra, and the last of these great gifts and benefits is afforded by way of Shabuah. Now, the thing that should be frightening if you are a Christian is this whole notion of that Old Testament, that Torah-based system, it was condemning. It's unlike this gift of grace that we are under now. Well, first of all, if God changed his plan, he wouldn't be trustworthy. God never says that he has changed his plan. But more important than that, Shavuah is a gift. Mm-hmm. It's a renewing and restoring gift. It's a, in Hebrew, it's a mincha, an offering given freely as a present without compensation. So it, Yahweh's plan going right to the heart of the Torah is about a free gift. The gift is free. Now, just because you need to understand it and respond to it doesn't change the fact that the gift is free. You know, it's like I could offer you a free meal at a free home, but if you don't show up, it doesn't do you any good. That doesn't change the fact that the meal and the home are free. Now, the thing that's interesting here is that karab, the operative verb to approach, it was written in the hifl, perfect consecutive. Sometimes the stems and the moods and the conjugations provide an enormous amount of information. The hifl stem says that the subject causes the object to participate in the action as if the subject and the object were the same. So this is God speaking to us. So the subject is Yahweh, inviting us to attend this day, saying that if we approach on this day, that he's going to empower the results. He's going to cause us to enjoy the benefits of being renewed and restored and affirmed. So the subject enables the object to enjoy the benefits of the verb, which is in this case renewing, restoring, and affirming, and through this approach. But as a consecutive, that's a the mood of volition. So it is something that we are given the opportunity to choose, and is the perfect, which is interesting here, is that we don't have to make a habit of approaching every Shavuah. Now, we're invited to do so. It's wise for us to do it. It doesn't say we have to continually approach every Shavuah. What the perfect says is, you know, one and done. If we do it, we receive the benefits. You know, the imperfect is ongoing. The perfect is a completed action. So it can convey one of two thoughts. Pardon?
Is it used here in the perfect?
It's used here in the perfect, which means that God isn't expecting a lot of us. You know, we celebrate.
You might get in prison if you can't do it.
Right. He says, you know, you celebrate
that,
this.
A terrible punishment. But
and one and done, and you're good. You know, it's not like, it's not like I'm going to re-empower you and re-enrich you and re-adopt you year after year. No, we do. I'm going to do those things once and for all, and you can receive them once and celebrate and receive it once for all. Now that does not mean that that there isn't an ongoing benefit from it. It just means that God is not expecting a lot of us here. We only have to do this one time. Now, because each of these Moed Mikrei serve to convey important truths, it is in our interest to celebrate them so that we're reminded of our enrichment and empowerment, and so that we can remind others that God has this plan.
I was going to say, that's a big part of Shavuah, is sharing it.
Right, is sharing, exactly.
Well, this also goes back to, like, when you go back and retranslate something, it's the same thing. You've learned so much more this time. Well, if you do it continuously or yearly,
yes.
How much you'll gain by just revisiting the same material over and over and over again. You say, oh, I didn't say that in Save Before.
Right. Now, what's interesting here is that the gift is Kadosh. And by the gift being Kadosh, the gift is renewing and restoring. And when you look at how Kadosh is used in connection with Yirmiyah 31, where Yahweh is restoring and renewing and affirming the covenant, there isn't a new one. This isn't about a new gift. This is about a restoring, renewing, and affirming gift. And it's the same word that describes the covenant in Yirmiyah 31, where Christians will take that, well, it's a new covenant. No, not what he said. It's a huge difference.
That's another one of those words. You look at every instance it's used, renew works, new very rarely works.
That is correct. And the basis of the word is its verbal root, and the verbal root means to renew. So it's very, very clear, very important. Now, the mikra is an all-inclusive affair. This one is. Men and women are invited, young and old, wealthy and poor, slave and free, goyim and yehudim. And the reason for that is we're being enriched and empowered to convey Yahweh's message. He wants the world to know it. Whether they accept it or not is their choice. He wants the world to know it. Also, when you look at Mikra and this particular day, it's really important to understand the corruption of the Greek word ecclesia, because it's this day that Christians have been beguiled to believe is the birth of their church. And yet there is no word even remotely akin to church in the Greek text. The Greek is ekklesia. It means to call out. Mikra means to call out. The ekklesia was a translation of what Yosha said, and what Yosha said is that he was going to build his calling out, his mikra. And so when you realize that God does not have a church, and there's no word even remotely akin to church, even in the Christian New Testament, and that Yosha's terminology was mikra, and this is the fourth mikra, there was no birth of a church on this day. There was another one of the confirmations of Yahweh's invitations, of which there are seven each year. This is the fourth of seven. And, of course, the fourth was fulfilled in year 4000 Yah, as it was predicted to be fulfilled in the fourth day of creation. The fourth day of creation is that the greater light will become a sign of the moed, of the meetings. And, indeed, that was what was fulfilled in year 4000 Yah. Moving on to the next statement in Kara. In fact, his book is actually named Kara, which is called out. You shall come bringing out of your homes two loaves of bread as an ascending wave offering, a double portion for a tenfold enrichment and empowerment. Now, here, most English translations will have Isharon, translated, changed to tithe. But the Hebrew word for tithe is asar. Isharon is based upon the concept of tenfold, and it means to enrich and to empower. Now, the reason that you can't render it here as a tithe, which is would be a 10%, is, first of all, tenfold and 10% are off by a factor of 100, right? You're talking about one-tenth,
yeah,
and tenfold, ten times. So that's a magnitude of 100 different. Also, the quantity here was how many loaves of bread?
Two.
It didn't say bring one of 10. You know, if you have 10 loaves of bread, bring one. It doesn't say, you know, if you have 100 loaves of bread, bring 10. It was two. So the quantity is already set at two. And this word, isharon, is being used, speaking of the double portion, which is shanim, the double portion of two loaves of bread can't be a tithe. It can't be a tenth. No, it's a double portion, and it's two. And so you have to use your head to say, well, then what is he talking about here? And then what you realize is the reason that you're bringing two loaves of bread is because this is for Yehudim and for Goyim.
Right.
You're bringing two loaves of bread because you have the benefits of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shabuah, the whole Torah teaching and the covenant by way of Yahweh's instruction. And then ultimately you're going to have the bread of life as Yosha, walking out of the pages of the Torah. So there are two loaves, this is the event where Goyim and Yehudim are invited. So that's why there's two. But
you know, I find it interesting that you know the other mikra, which Goyim are invited to, is Passover, but there's a caveat to them being allowed to participate in Passover.
Yeah.
And that's that they become circumcised.
But
it also states there that then they are considered just as the natural born. So at that point, they're no longer Gentiles. They're no longer Goyim. They are Yisrael. But in this case, there's no caveat, so you could be a Gentile. You don't have to become part of Yisrael to participate in this. To participate in Passover, you have to become Yisrael.
Correct. You have to be not only circumcised, but you have to be circumcised as a Gentile because you choose out of love the benefits.
A desire to be purchased and bought.
Included. Yeah, a desire to be part of the family has to be the motivation for being circumcised. So just being circumcised doesn't qualify you. You have to be circumcised because of your desire to be part of the family. And so you are fulfilling, if you will, the signing your name to the covenant, the fifth purpose of, you know, to be
becoming
and participating in Passover by doing those two things, you are accepting the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you become Yisrael.
Right. At that point, you are walking away from all of the religious practices of the rest of the world. So you're fulfilling the opening requirement of the covenant to be circumcised and to participate in Pesach because of your desire to be part of the family. Number two, you are using that as the path to walk to God to become perfect because Pesach and Matzah are one event. That's the second condition of the covenant. You've chosen at that point to trust and rely on Yahweh. Otherwise, you'd be no reason whatsoever that you'd be becoming circumcised and also attending Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. You are the fourth condition, which is to observe the conditions of the covenant. You're doing exactly that. You, by being circumcised, you're meeting the fifth, which is to be circumcised. Mm-hmm. So, you really, what you're saying is that you are covenant to observe.
You are Yisrael.
That's right. And you are you aren't just Yisrael in the broad sense. You're Yisrael in the very
the
literal meaning
sense of the word.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, there's Yisrael
not
can
racially,
mean to struggle,
but spiritually.
To struggle with God and to wrestle with God. It also can mean to engage and endure with God. So and to be empowered by him.
I
so in the truest sense. Yeah, I do too. But God uses the Yisrael to speak of those who are estranged from him, as well as his love for it. So it's.
So I would say, yeah, that's the difference between being, physically or, you know, heretically Yisrael. Yeah, there is
right.
a, you know, yeah, right. birthright of being, you know, Yehudi, but there's also the spiritual Israel.
Divorce family, though.
Yeah, yeah. That's, by the way, it's so interesting too that that you know you talk about Yisrael, and we talked about Judaizers. Realistically, it is impossible. I mean, the very concept of being a Judaizer, to causing somebody to become Jewish, that's an impossibility. You cannot change your race. So that aspect of Judaizer you can throw away because there is no no concept of changing race. And Paul never once criticizes the Talmud, which is what Judaism is
the
based
Jewish
on.
The Jewish religion is based on.
Yeah, the Jewish religion is based upon the Talmud, and he never once criticizes the Talmud. So it makes no sense from that perspective either. It is.
I'm not a Judaizer. I'm not trying to convince you to become racially or religiously Jewish. I don't think you should be.
Correct.
Well, and if you're racially Jewish, you have no control. And if you're religiously Jewish, I'm against you.
Yeah. Now, Paul's argument was those who were Torah observant. And if your argument is against those who were Torah observant, who was the only one who was perfectly Torah observant?
Yahusha.
Right.
Yeah.
So Paul was
actually
speaking
against. You claim Christian means to be Christ-like. Your Christ
right.
was Torah observant.
Yeah, that is cool. Well, yeah, if you knew his actual title, which is not Christ. And his name was
but
not Christ.
But even if you just take,
Yahusha.
You know, the English translations
right.
where they name him Christ, you know, you read a King James Bible, he was Torah observant.
That is correct. And he said emphatically that no aspect of the Torah will be negated in any way so long as the heavens and earth exist. Now, and the reason he did that, and it's so powerful here in this particular case, because our enrichment and empowerment is with the Torah. That is the Torah, is the great gift that enriches us and enlightens us and empowers us. That the reason that it will continue to exist every yod, the smallest letter, the first letter in Yahweh's name, and tittle, which are the strokes that comprise the rest of the Hebrew letters, the reason that none of those will be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist is that when he creates a new universe and the only ones that are with him are covenant members, at that point, the vast preponderance of the existing Torah will cease to exist. Because the vast preponderance of the existing, I mean, the overwhelming preponderance of the existing Torah, have no merit. There are aspects that will. The celebration of Shavuot will have merit, but all of the
what need do you have for a map once you've reached the destination?
Yeah. What you need. Because eternity is a this great journey and of empowerment and enrichment. What you need is operating instructions. You're going to be given there's just no no human metaphor to explain it. But the most the fastest, most powerful aircraft ever designed by a billion fold, and you're now the pilot of that, and you can travel anywhere in the universe. And do anything you wish to do. Yeah, you're going to need some really, really sophisticated operating instructions, so that you don't
throw
yourself up. Yeah, and so what's going to happen is the existing Torah, capital T, is going to be replaced by Torah, lowercase T, which is God's instructions and directions as to how to maximize our enjoyment out of eternity and all of the empowerment and enrichment that we're going to have as beings comprised of light. Now, we will be able to go to emerging galaxies and solar systems. And I'm convinced that we will be able there to actually conceive life, to experiment, to conduct research. There's things that God's going to say, you know, you ought not do. Like, I would assume there will be black holes.
There's another human
there as well. Right, you know, you might want to examine them from a distance, but maybe the instruction is don't go in one of those.
Yeah.
No, just don't do that. I can get you out of it, but I really did just – that's not a good experience. Don't go in one of those. And it might be an experience of saying, you know, you're free to create life because life is really the most interesting part of creation, and experiment with life. But I don't want you to give any one of your any life form that you create a nesama. I don't want you to give a being with the ability to reason.
There's too much in that for you right now.
Right. Right.
Let's not mess with that.
So, is there any
reason to think of this as a journey, as a destination? I don't think of that anymore. I think of it as an ongoing thing, like a circle.
We were talking
about all these crosswords. You know,
why would
you
want to create a new universe? Why would
you create
a new universe?
You keep on moving with Yahweh. His henna is standing up, engaged, and walking. We're always going from journey to journey, from more education, more this, more that. It's not a destination. You know, I thought about that when we were doing the Section 8 of observations, and I got stuck on the word for tent. And it seems really silly, but I said, okay, well, let's examine tent a minute, because my brain kind of goes funny places now. And I'm thinking about a tent is the most temporary of anything, temporary home of anything. And Yahweh loves being in his tent. And it's more symbolic than anything that Solomon built. That didn't last very long.
The tabernacle.
You know, so he's not in love with some building, some permanent structure or destination place.
Right.
Not even Jewish.
He kept on telling everyone, said, hey, did I once tell you needed to build a permanent house for me? Ever once? You know, I like the tent. I mean, why is Susa named after shelters, tent, booths, tents, camping out? As a matter of fact, I think that that's part of the idea of eternity, is that just as Yahweh camped out in Eden with Adam and Chawa, I think as we go explore the new universe, we're going to camp out in various places in it. Just as when I was younger and my sons were younger, we went on campouts. We backpacked and carried our tent and erected our tent at each night's destination and built a campfire and had all of the joys of camping out. And then the next day we would pick up our tent and put it back in our packs and we'd go hike some more and find another lovely spot and pitch our tent again. It's a, you know, as I say, there isn't any reason for Yahweh to create a new universe unless he wants us to enjoy not only being witnesses to creation, but being participants. Unless he wants us to be able to say, all right, you know, this last time I created a platypus. I think that was fairly creative. It's your turn. You think that a camel was a horse by committee? You try. let's go and enjoy this together. Let's go off and see what we can all come up with. Let's see what we can do. Let's try different things. See how they turn out.
I'm going to be working on a Sasquatch.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Why not? A Pegasus, a winged horse. That sounds like a kind of a fun thing to create. I would love to be able to see actual dinosaurs. Wouldn't that be neat?
Yeah.
Depending on.
I know. They're not going back through light, so I understand. But.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, but we will be able to, at any time, transition into mortal beings so that we can actually hike and walk and, you know, and drink from the stream and feel the warmth of another sun and the breeze and than to meet back together to celebrate these marvelous meals.
Yeah, I can't imagine it couldn't, it won't be that way. I think you just, it's too much pleasure, if you would.
So in this particular case, as I tried to understand Isharon, what I came to realize that Isharon is a combination of Ishar, which means 10, and Ashar, which means being enriched, and Own, which means being empowered. So it is a tenfold enrichment and empowerment. Well, let's think about that for a moment. Tenfold sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But tenfold is nothing compared to going from three dimensions to four.
Right.
That's an infinite increase.
That's infinite.
Right. And then from four to five is an infinity squared.
On top of an infinite.
Correct. And then from five to six is infinity cubed. And then three to seven is infinity to the fourth power.
That's a big number.
Infinity is a number that never becomes rational, never ceases, which means requires eternal growth, always growing. But if you multiply infinity times infinity times infinity times infinity, you're at the seventh dimension. So a three-dimensional construct with a soul, with a neshama, conscience, that is enriched and empowered tenfold is a trifle. It's as I said, it's a symbol. It's symbolic of what is ultimately going to happen, because ultimately we're going to be enriched and empowered and enlightened to the infinity, to the fourth power. Which is beyond our imagination, greater than tenfold. But you know, if you look at what we know, celebrate, and understand today,
yes,
by comparison to what we knew and understood, whether it was 5 years, 10 years, 15 or 20 years ago,
yes,
more than tenfold.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been enriched and empowered with understanding far more than tenfold.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what the word means, and that is what Yahweh is offering. And I think you then go to, okay, what is Yahweh's means to enrich and to enlighten to Isharon? Well, what's the most enriching and empowering thing in the universe? What is the very thing that Yahusha says, do not think that I came to do away with, instead to fulfill what? The Torah.
The Torah.
The Torah is the most valuable document in the universe. From Yahweh's perspective, the Torah is light.
Think about what you just said.
To restore the soul. Yeah.
Everybody thinks we're either a cult or crazy, because we want to study the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
As a Christian, I carried the little book around with me, and most of it was the Torah. Most of the stuff I read was in the Torah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and now all of a sudden I'm some kind of nutcase because I want to tell you what. And everything that Yahusha said, which was in Greek, and we don't even have a good example, I mean a really good copy to even know what he said precisely.
Correct. Right.
Pretty sure, because he was quoting the Torah. And we have to But be that as it may, so much of what would happen, like in the 22nd Psalm and so, is much better witness than anything in the New Testament. And somehow we're nutcases because we're studying the Torah.
Listen, if you're going to be labeled
that
nut,
playing around that,
because you find,
I know it's true.
Primary revelation to humankind. Interesting. Because you find Yahweh's principal revelation to humankind enlightening and enriching, if if somebody wants to label you a nut because you happen to find benefit, tremendous benefit, from studying Yahweh's observing, Yahweh's testimony, then so be it. So be it. I'm happy. I'm happy to be accused of
yeah. That. But Yahweh Biden said, you know, he's the Word. He's the living Word. That's the living Torah.
Oh, correct.
Give me a break. What is, you know?
I'm doing exactly what you tell me I should be doing. You keep telling me I need to read the Bible. I need to study the Bible. You need to read this. Now I start doing it, and all of a sudden I'm crazy.
We were gardening this morning out in the front yard, and the Jehovah's Witnesses came up.
Oh,
somehow
my.
They like to work our neighborhood. And she came up and says, I want to give you this pamphlet. Because we're encouraging people to study the Bible. And I said, I read the Torah and study it every day. And she put it back. Said, oh, well, good. I was waiting to be engaged. I hope she's just going to ask me, what's the Torah?
I'm quite certain that there is no Jehovah. Like, I'm positive there's no Jehovah.
Well, I was ready. I was saying, well, guys, maybe this is okay. I'm going to be real sweet, and I'm just going to engage her and see if she'll engage, and she wouldn't engage. They just put the pamphlet back and said, well, that's good. You have a lovely garden. Bye.
Not even going to try and argue again.
I had so high hopes. I said, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do some real shabooing.
You are a Jehovah's Witness. Why don't you find, where'd you find that name?
I have no trouble debating this part, you know.
Yeah, since there's no J and no B.
No J and there's no B.
And in Hebrew.
Hebrew and
how could that be possible?
And don't you think you ought to know somebody's name before you represent them?
Before you claim.
Before we move to where we're at now, there was a Jehovah's Witness place right around the corner from our apartment. I kept waiting for them to show up at the house, but never did.
Yeah.
It was one of those I was looking for. I remember when I was in high school, I would visit my mom in Arizona, and they had a big Mormon population. And I loved when the Mormons would come by. This was back when I was agnostic, and I would just love to argue and debate with the religious people and make them look like fools. And I loved when the Mormons would come by, and I could just make them look like complete idiots. It's even better now that
Mormon
I can use Yahweh's word to do it.
Scientology are very similar in terms of the levels of stupidity.
Yeah.
It is interesting, of course, that Mormonism and Scientology both attempt to garner some credibility to fit within society by both calling themselves churches and both using the symbol of a, like you look at the, it's Scientology, their symbol is a cross.
Yeah, double cross.
And, you know, and it's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Mormonism. And yet the Book of Mormon is an absolute contradiction of everything Yosha said. So, it's amazing that people are so easily fooled. And
that's
the big
Floyd
issue on Mormonism,
Muhammad and
he was,
Paul used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they learned from the quote.
I will tell you that the world's dumb. You know, when you talk about the world's dumbest religion, my view is that it's Islam. That it's impossible to read the Quran and be rational and come away with any conclusion other than this is the worst book ever written. If this book was inspired by God, then there is no
God.
I don't want to know him, and second of all, I can't be the same God that conceived life and that created the universe, because it is really stupid and immoral and plagiarized. It's so awesomely stupid that you just shake your head. But I've studied enough of Mormonism to know that its basic premise, which is that the Native Americans were Jews who sailed from Israel to the Americas. Absolutely.
Genetic testing pretty much put an end to that.
absolute proof that is untrue.
Yeah.
And of course, if were to have his people bring over a testimony, the testimony they would have brought over, A, would have been written in Hebrew and not have been deciphered, and number two would have been the Torah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joseph Smith was just a con man, and not even a very good one. And to, you know, it's
but when he claimed that, you know, the translation, you know, he was given, you know, the ability to translate the Egyptian scroll, and it was this lost testament of Christ and all that.
Then we get the Rosetta Stone, it's the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
Yeah, that's right. It was about Abraham.
But then we get the Rosetta Stone, and we're able
to decipher it and go, oh, no, this is just the Egyptian Book of the Dead. We've got a copy of that everywhere because it was very common.
Right. No, no, he made an absolute and utter fool of himself in everything that he said and did, and it's obvious that he did. And so to be a Mormon, you just have to be an unthinking nitwit. But the same thing is true with, you know, L. Ron Hubbard in creating Scientology on a bet. I know, he says, you know, I'm a science fiction writer. I can create a religion that's so far-fetched people will believe it. You know, and they did.
They did.
Yeah, and they did. So, you know, you look at Judaism and the notion that you can say that God was such a lousy communicator that we can't pronounce his name, and that he needed rabbis to provide arguments to tell you how to live because, you know, he didn't provide information that any person could actually follow. Right, incomplete and undecipherable by ordinary people. Therefore, you need us to have these arguments, the Talmud. And why would anybody in their right mind believe that?
Yeah.
And particularly with...
You can read it, why can't I read it?
Right. And if rabbis were the appointed conveyors of Yahweh's message... Why is there no mention of a rabbi in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just shake your head and say, what's wrong with people for doing this? And, you know, I understand that most people are not going to consider Yahweh's testimony, not on Shavuot, not on any day, because they won't even conceive of the idea that they've been lied to in their religion. But if you take what Paul said and compare it to what God said, they're in irresolvable conflict from beginning to end. It's impossible, absolutely rationally impossible, if you do just a modicum of investigation, that Paul told the truth. Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
His testimony was the opposite of Yosha's. And as such, there is no chance whatsoever that he was chosen by Yosha to represent him. And there is a thousand reasons to come to that conclusion, including him admitting that he was demon-possessed.
Pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty
good clue. Or the fact that he says that, you know, he was blinded by and struck so he was lame by Yosha on the road to Damascus, having exactly the opposite effect of that Yosha had on all of those he actually met with, and that he and maybe two others saw him when Yosha said, when next I'm seen, I'll be seen by the entire world at the same time. And, you know, that doesn't matter how deep you dig.
Yeah.
There are 1,000 contradictions, and so it's just your unwillingness to consider the evidence. Now, the Torah is only enriching and empowering if you're willing to consider what it says. But that is Shavuot, by the way. It's an entirety. It's if you look at its fulfillment in year 4000, Yah 33 CE, 100% of its fulfillment was the set-apart spirit enabling those who had been the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, and Makotah, who were members of the covenant, to convey in the words spoken by men Yahweh's message. That was the entire purpose of it. And Yahweh's message is conveyed in his Torah, through his teaching. So the Torah is the source of our enrichment and empowerment. Shavua is the result of the Torah. If you shamar Torah, then you have the benefit of Shavua. I think that may be one of the reasons why it says, you know, Shavua in the perfect tense, that you approach in the perfect tense, which means one and done. It, by the way, it doesn't necessarily mean one and done. All the perfect tense means is that it doesn't have to be something that you do habitually all the time. It's a completed action, either in the past, present, and future. A completed action could occur 100 times, but ultimately isn't continued. Is all it means. So, but you know, by observing the Torah, you are in effect celebrating Shavua every day.
Yeah.
You know, every day we translate and seek to understand. Like tent, the word that you went off on here this week. You know, sukkah is one of Oel and sukkah are both words for tent. Oel is the most common word for tent. You know, why is Yahweh so thrilled with, so happy with, so content with the tent?
Because he likes to teach. He's trying to tell you something. If you do it that way, every time you're looking for it, you figure it out, I think.
Right. Right. You know, the purpose of the Torah isn't to give me a home, for me to provide you with a home. You know, I'm going to camp out here with you temporarily so that you can live with me forever. And when you're living with me forever, we're going to experience forever by camping out in the universe that you're going to not only witness, but participate in making along with me.
Boy, what an offer.
Yeah, what an offer. And I'm there are very few things in my life that I enjoyed more than backpacking, particularly in the Sierras, with my sons, camping out. You know, marvelous experiment, and you know, to be able to do it without getting blisters from the hiking boots and without getting lightheaded for climbing into the altitude and for eating marvelous cuts of meats and wine as opposed to dry light food and tang, you know, I'm going to be all over that. You know.
We did an awful lot of stuff with horseback riding. We had horses, and we also did a lot of things with, we had a boat and go down the Alabama River and stuff like that. So I said, no, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Boys, a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a motorhome for a while. That was really fun. We had a cabin up in a lake, and a boat there, and, you know, great fun, with that as well. Yeah. Yeah. Life's experience with our families. It's marvelous thing, and that's what God's going to do. It's going to be fun. All right, I'm going to go and rest my back.
You will.
Yep. My the ice that I have that has been numbing it has finally thawed, and so I'm going to call it a day. I hung with you longer than I thought I would.
I won't be with you. You know, you got my email about
it. I was going to say, you made it further than we thought, so.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Yeah. It only about three or four times that it gave me a jolt where I moved and ooh, but I don't even think you heard me scream.
No, it did.
No.
Do a trooper.
You did good.
You know, what's interesting now is because I've been sitting down doing this, when I stand up, I can the whole process for the first like 5 minutes that I stand up. Oh, I'm like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's going to take a while now for me to unravel all of this. All right. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed doing this with you, fellas.
Yeah. Happy
good
night.
Always a good time.
Happy Shabbat. Happy Shabbat. Good night.
Yeah.
Happy Shabbat. Bye.
Good night.
Good night.